I just love seeing you all come in like this.
He's talking about the new refiners joining the Severed Patreon page. Just $5 a month and no cranial drill required. Go to patreon.com/severedpod.
Okay, you're all set.
Severed, the ultimate severance podcast.
Welcome back, Refiner. I'm glad to see you've returned for more of Severed, the Ultimate Severance Podcast. I'm your host, Alan S. Our look at those things that inspired Dan Erickson as he was creating Severance continues with another installment of Severed Origins. This is the second and final part of our epic breakdown of the epic fairy tale, Joe versus the Volcano. As always, Refiner's head-deforming, nightmare-inducing spoilers are ahead for Joe versus the Volcano. If you somehow come to this part first, you need to stop everything right now and go find part one of the Origins breakdown of 1990s Joe versus the Volcano. Last time out, we met Joe Banks. He's a depressed hypochondriac and former fireman who is now working a dead-end job in the advertising library at a medical supply house. After being given a questionable diagnosis by a Dr. Ellison, Joe thinks he only has 6 months left to live. His malady? A brain cloud. It's very rare and very destructive, but it has absolutely no symptoms. A wealthy and eccentric businessman is then given the heads up about Joe's condition, which sounds crazy, I know, but this was 1990. The businessman offers to treat Joe like a king for the rest of his life if Joe agrees to jump into a volcano within the next 20 days. If Joe jumps, the businessman will be allowed to mine a rare and fictional mineral found only on the island where the volcano is located. As a bonus, the islanders will have completed an every 100-year ritual, which is supposed to keep the volcano from exploding and sinking the island. Joe agrees to do it. At the end of part one, we had just arrived at the boat, which will take him to the island of Waponi Wu. So if you're ready, refiners, it's time to once again open the Origins file called Joe versus the Volcano. We start part two of our breakdown at the marina, where Joe is supposed to catch his ride. Joe spent the morning in the company of Angelica Granamore, daughter to Samuel and a publicly outed flibbertigibbet. I covered the meaning and history of that word in part one. Since then, patron refiner Jonathan E. has pointed out one of the most iconic uses of this word in pop culture. The song Maria from The Sound of Music uses this word.
How do you find a word that means Maria?
A flibbertigibbet, a will-o'-the-wisp,
a clown.
Although I've heard that song my entire life, I had no idea what they were wedging in there.
Flibbertigibbet.
Thanks, Jonathan, for the heads up. I found a promo piece for this movie on YouTube. It's light and primarily explains the premise, but we do get some comments from both Meg and Tom about the characters. As for Angelica...
Angelica is sort of like a teenage sort of nightmare.
Who is the Los Angeles waif who has given herself over to a lifestyle that... has taken her soul away, and she cannot get it back, even no matter how much she tried.
We just found out at breakfast that Joe will be traveling the last leg of his journey with Patricia Granamore.
She's a captain of her own ship. It's a great metaphor, really.
She's also Angelica's half-sister. Joe and Angelica are standing on a deck overlooking the dock where the boat is moored. Joe's enormous steamer trunks are waiting on the dock. Sitting on top of the steamer trunks is the lovely and blonde Patricia. It doesn't take long to realize she has a bit of an attitude.
What's the trunks, Felix?
Felix? Who's she talking to?
Well, my name's not Felix, it's Joe.
Ooh, now there's the tough talk that'll set her straight. Patricia comes a bit closer. It's obvious just how much she and Angelica look alike.
That's your half-sister?
Yeah.
They could almost be the same person. Patricia then destroys whatever confidence Joe might have had left regarding his Horn of Africa outfit.
That outfit's wearing you, Felix.
Angelica, you remember, had already questioned his fashion sense at breakfast. Joe again tells her his name. Why is she calling him Felix?
I'm calling you Felix because I do what I want.
She is feisty. Patricia acknowledges her sister.
Hello, Angelica.
Hello, Patricia.
I love that we have Meg talking to Meg, but because of the staging, we don't have to endure any attempt at splitting split-screen effects. Movies have been trying to get this same person playing two roles split-screen right since the original Parent Trap.
Do you know where Daddy is?
Weirdly, Patricia fills Felix, or I mean Joe, in here on the backstory about this little ritual between the sisters.
See, we never know where our father is, and we always suspect that the other one knows, but it's all phone calls and telegrams, eh, Angelica?
Since he got a mention, I was really hoping Lloyd Bridges might show up in later scenes. Unfortunately, we only got Mr. Bridges for the one scene where he hired Joe. As the crew stows Joe's trunks, and aside, podcast listener Drew Wells pointed out some interesting parallels about this third version of Ms. Ryan. Is Patricia a blueprint for Helly? She's a headstrong heiress, scrappy, willful, and working for Daddy in a situation that seems beneficial in some respects, but might be more against her will than anything. She also doesn't have a clue as to why she's doing what she's doing, but she goes ahead anyway. Interesting parallels and crossovers. Thanks for the comment, Drew. Angelica slowly takes off her sunglasses.
You're in a rotten mood. It's the sunshine. Gets me down.
When you think about it, what's happening here is very cool. Meg is talking to herself, and very believably. I would imagine there was someone off camera doing the response lines for each side to help with the pacing. Still, it's hard to make it sound like you're carrying on a conversation with yourself.
Where are you going?
She's a flibbertigibbet, remember?
Can you believe it? Dad said not to tell you. Goes with my theory. Power makes you paranoid.
The guys carrying Joe's monster steamer trunks aboard are Mike and Tony. They're two-thirds of the crew of the Tweedledee. They're being played by David Burton as Mike and Joe Conrad Pochran as Tony. Both of these guys are actually stuntmen. Like here, sometimes when you're on a set doing stunts, you wind up covering scenes as an actor. David, as Mike, has 13 actor credits, but 53 stunt credits. He started stunting in 1983. His last listed project was in 2005's Domino. A couple of favorite titles from David's list. He did a stunt car hit in the original Dude, Where's My Car? From 2000. He was also a stunt player in Thelma and Louise and Edward Scissorhands. John, as Tony, has 6 actor credits and a total of 44 stunt credits on his IMDb profile. John started stunting in 1982. Some of his notable stunt projects include appearances in To Live and Die in L.A., The Fabulous Baker Boys, and Universal Soldier. I did notice a lot of John's titles include numbers in them. For example, Stepfather 3, Alligator 2, The Mutation, Beastmaster 3, The Eye of Braxis, and Rush Hour 3. The guys have the trunks loaded. They tell the skipper it's time to cast off.
Get ready to heave, Felix.
Joe's had about enough of this Felix stuff. He puts his Horn of Africa attired foot down.
My name is Joseph or Joe.
Okay, now there's the voice of authority wayward Patricia needs.
All right, Joe.
You can just hear her respect for authority already, can't you? Patricia tells him to hurry it up. She steps over to the boat as we cut to Joe and Angelica having a moment of goodbye.
Wish me luck.
Good luck.
Angelica tells him he's shaking. He hadn't noticed. Joe then chastely leans in and gives Angelica a little peck on the cheek. Angelica looks both elated and depressed watching Joe's departure. As we hold on Angelica for a few seconds, we can hear the crew.
Get off the bow.
Cut to the Tweedledee heading out. Tom Hanks is standing on the main deck looking back towards Angelica. I so wanted him to do the Forrest Gump fast wave in that moment. Angelica walks down the dock for a final glimpse of Joe. It's very much a scene from a 1940s adventure romance. Joe then pulls off his wide-brimmed safari hat, gives it a look, and tosses it in the water. More symbolism with the hats. This contrived version of Joe, the one he's been trying to create since the New York shopping trip, is now over. This new version of Joe is a soulful and introspective man taking his final walk to eternity. He'll also have to deal with horribly racist native stereotypes, orange soda, a typhoon, and a killer hammerhead shark, among other oddball things. The hat disappears below the churning water, the music swells, and we ride along with the Tweedledee for a bit. There is a heroic fly around as the schooner is fully rigged. It's pretty impressive. These shots of the ship on the water were filmed in one of two places, either at the Lanai Lookout just off the coast of Honolulu, Hawaii, or in a tank at MGM Studios. As a general rule, if the water is calm, it's Hawaii. If the storm is churning or we're seeing waves, those scenes are being shot in the MGM tank. Sometimes they will cut back and forth between the two locations within the same scene. The sun is down, the sky is mottled with a beautiful sunset. Joe and Patricia are seated on the main deck in front of the ship's wheel. One of the crew members places plates of food in front of them.
Well, it looks delicious.
We eat well aboard the Tweedledee.
Look behind Joe's head in the side shot. Joe is sitting in front of an enormous bouquet of sunflowers. The sunflower is, of course, emblematic of the sun, but in Chinese culture, it is also a symbol of long life, good fortune, and vitality. Joe asks what she means by Tweedledee.
Yeah, it's the name of the boat.
Don't worry, we'll get to this name, just not yet. Patricia is still harboring some of her barely concealed contempt from earlier. She roughly steers the conversation to a topic where she would like some answers.
So, we're going to the island of Waipouni Wu.
Joe's a bit feisty as well. He says, I guess so. She wants to know why.
You don't know.
No.
Patricia has never been, but she then pulls out a book loaded with information about the Waiponis. This lost tribe on the tiny island seems to have been studied rather extensively. Patricia opens the book and becomes an exposition bomb, exploding all over the place. She says she knows the name means little island with a big volcano.
And then people, the Waiponis, like orange soda.
This is new information for Joe. Patricia reads from the volume.
1800 years ago, a Roman galley with a crew of Jews and Druids got caught in a huge storm off Carthage.
This storm swept the galley a good 1,000 miles off course. They were on the wrong side of the Horn of Africa when they attempted to return. Instead of heading to Rome, they sailed deep into the South Pacific.
Finally ended up colonizing a lightly populated Polynesian island, which they named Waipouni Wu.
Druids were priests of the ancient Celtic world. The practice of Druidry was thought to have originated in about the 4th century BCE in modern Wales. The script plays with this weird pairing in some borderline racist ways.
Thus was born the Waipouni culture, a mixture of Polynesian, Celtic, Hebrew, and Latin influences.
This misplaced Roman galley managed to mix Welsh priests and Jewish slaves in with Polynesian natives. Patricia tells us the modern-day Waiponis are known for two things, their love of orange soda
and no sense of direction.
Well, of course, these are the descendants of the people who went the wrong way back to Rome. Aside from the bit about the orange soda, Joe isn't all that interested in Waiponi lore. He wants to know why Patricia was such a snot back on the dock.
Because you work for my father, and I'm angry with my father.
Oh, Samuel? Now, how could she be mad at Lloyd Bridges? Although, if you think about it, he is in the midst of a plan to send an innocent and healthy man to his death just so Graynamore Industries can get their hands on a rare element. When you say it that way, it does sound kind of mercenary and evil. Joe asks why she's angry with Daddy.
Because he's never around.
And if she knew about the sending this guy to his death thing, I'm sure she wouldn't be thrilled about that either. Joe logically asks if he's never around and she is mad at him, why is she working for him? Well, it's because she's not.
My transport of you is strictly a favor.
This explanation doesn't sound legit to Joe.
You do favors for people you're mad at?
She isn't giving him the whole story.
He said he'd give me this boat if I took you.
But she doesn't work for him, and Joe does, so Patricia believes this makes her a better person and justifies her anger. Joe is blown away by the gift of such a cool boat. Patricia doesn't think he'll miss it. He does have another one.
This is the Tweedledee. There's a Tweedledum, too.
And I told you we'd get to the name. Most people know the names Tweedledum and Tweedledee from the 1871 Lewis Carroll novel, Through the Looking Glass and What Alice Found There. Although made famous by Carroll, the names were first used more than 150 years earlier by the poet John Byrom in 1725. Byrom was using the names to make fun of a quarrel between the composers George Friedrich Handel and Giovanni Bononcini. He was saying there was very little difference between the two men's music. One went Tweedledum, where the other went Tweedledee. Lewis Carroll appropriated the names for a pair of full-bodied twins in his Alice story. These two twins agree to battle each other, but they never do. The appearance of a black crow sends them both running. Where Byram's Tweedledum and Tweedledee were constantly at odds, Carol's version of the brothers never contradict each other. On the contrary, their comments complement each other's words. Although one of the names does contain the word dumb, neither brother is necessarily dumb. They are identical, which is the connection here. Both of these boats are the same.
Well, I guess that makes everything okay, then.
Patricia gets a bit annoyed at this summation.
Yes, it does.
We cut to a long shot of the Tweedledee on the water at night. This might be a miniature. This shot transitions us to Joe's stateroom. Patricia is checking in on him.
Is this okay for you?
Joe says sure, he's reading something, possibly his copy of the Odyssey from the office. Patricia is making conversation and killing time. She seems to be enamored with this new person in her orbit. She tells him where everybody sleeps on the boat. She keeps leaving, then coming back. She says she's sorry for being so rude on the dock.
So
she leaves again. The shot holds on Joe, and Patricia comes back into frame.
Did you sleep with my sister?
Maybe a bit of jealousy here. Joe honestly tells her no.
Actually, she's my half-sister.
She pauses, like this information might change his answer.
No, I didn't.
Okay.
She leaves and returns to frame again.
Do you like to fish?
Sure.
So maybe tomorrow they can do some fishing. The fact she's just hanging around is getting really obvious. She asks if Mike told him how the bathroom works. Well, yeah. She then tells him where the light switch is located.
Do you want me to turn it off while I go?
He's kind of trying to read, but it doesn't seem like she is actually going to go unless she does this.
Okay.
Once the room is in darkness, Patricia begins baring her soul to this stranger.
I love my sister. I know she screwed up.
Well, okay, so this is not a shocking revelation.
I love my father, even though I never see him, and he's not so great when I do see him.
Again, I was holding out hope for another scene with Lloyd Bridges.
I picked the wrong week to quit sniffing glue.
She says she's very nervous about this trip.
He didn't tell me anything, and you don't seem to be telling me anything. But it's more than that.
Her whole life, she's tried to avoid her father's control. Now, she's mad at herself, realizing she's fallen into one of his traps.
He knew I wanted this boat, and he used it, and he got me working for him, which I swore I would never do.
She feels ashamed. She had a price. When Daddy figured out her price, she caved on her principles.
He named it, and now I know that about myself.
It's a sobering realization. She says the way she treated Joe on the dock was her kicking herself for selling out.
Which isn't fair to you.
She doesn't know his situation, but she's saying all these things to this stranger because they're going to be on this little boat for a while, and
I'm soul sick.
She's telling him now because eventually he'll be able to see it. Here's another reference to souls in this movie. Is she soul sick because she caved into Daddy? Or was there soul sickness already happening before and this realization has added to it? Patricia is not the only soul sick Grainamore sister. Angelica is too.
And if you slept with her, then I would have known something about you.
But he didn't. He remains a good guy in her eyes because he didn't take advantage of a soul sick damsel.
You didn't. And I believe you.
Joe's glad. She then asks him if he's ever slept on a boat before. He says he hasn't.
It really affects your dreams. I look forward to it, even though sometimes the dreams really shake me up.
I kind of figured this was setting us up for a dream sequence look inside Joe's head. Nope, the weird dreams are never referenced again. We then cut to one of multiple music videos we're going to encounter on this voyage. There's not a lot of revelation happening on the boat. Until we get to Waponi Woo, there really isn't any more story to tell, but we do need to eat up some screen time getting there. Enter the Young Rascals in their movie soundtrack staple, Good Lovin'. It was a number one hit from 1966. It's become a fixture of movie and TV soundtracks after it appeared in the 1983 hit, The Big Chill.
One, two, three!
Good love! Good love! Good love!
It's sunny and the sea is calm. Joe and Patricia are both fishing off the back of the boat. As the music plays, we watch Patricia keep reeling them in, but Joe doesn't get a bite. We do get a few mimed interactions here between Joe and the character Dagmar. She's the woman in the white jumpsuit and big sunglasses. Dagmar is being played by Amanda Plummer. This is a year or two before anyone would have said, "Wow, Amanda Plummer, really?" She'd been working pretty consistently since 1980, but hadn't had a real breakthrough just yet. Amanda is an American actress born in New York in 1957. Her parents are Canadian actor Christopher Plummer and American actress Tammy Grimes. The world got to know Amanda after her breakout role as Lydia, opposite Robin Williams in The Fisher King, a year later in 1991. There's an origins connection here. Fisher King was directed by Terry Gilliam. Amanda was also the talk of the town after Quentin Tarantino wrote the Pulp Fiction robbing a diner scene with both her and Tim Roth in mind.
I love you, pumpkin.
I love you, honey bunny.
Everybody be cool, this is a robbery!
Any of you fucking pricks move! And I'll execute every motherfucking last one of you!
Amanda has 113 credits on her IMDb profile. Most recently, she's appeared in 6 episodes of the TV series Star Trek Picard. As an origins reference, I think Dagmar and Switch from The Matrix would have gotten along well together. I'm even betting they hang out in a lot of the same clubs. Michelob got some love here on the deck. I'm sure they paid to be included in this scene. Dagmar is definitely enjoying a cold bottle. We get a good 90 seconds of messing around to good lovin' before Joe finally pulls in whatever it is he's caught. When Joe's catch emerges from the water, it's a very obvious puppet of a hammerhead shark. It looks like something you'd see pop over the wall on Sesame Street. Joe, screaming, drops it back in the ocean and runs like he's in an improv skit. This shark was designed by visual effects expert Robert Short. Robert is a legitimate visual effects pro with 23 credits on his IMDb profile. He even owns Robert Short Productions. This shark is not one of those 23 credits. Robert seems to have buried this hammerhead design in another credit list, Additional Crew. This is how he's credited in this movie, but there are other members of the visual effects department who are listed as being part of Robert Short Productions. You'd think Robert himself would also want to be credited as a visual effects expert, unless maybe Robert wasn't all that proud of this creation. I'm not saying I could do better, but I don't think I'd do a whole lot worse, and I don't call myself a visual effects expert. Night 2 on the Tweedledee is more relaxed than the first night.
So I'm leaving you on this island?
That's right.
We're looking at paper lanterns hanging on the deck and stars behind.
How long?
For the rest of my life.
I can't imagine that.
She could if she knew the rest of his life was only going to be a couple of days. Joe changes the subject. He's still marveling at the night sky.
Are you used to this?
What?
He means the ocean, the stars. Dinner appears to be over. They do eat well on board the Tweedledee. A cut glass brandy decanter is still sitting on the white cloth-covered table. Patricia is relaxing on a beanbag chair. She says you never get used to this.
Why do you think I want this boat? All I want to do is sail away.
Joe wants to know where she'd go. Patricia answers with a phrase that will become a callback later.
Away from the things of man.
Although this sounds very poetic and earthy, it's kind of an impossible goal. There aren't many places on Earth left untouched by man. Even the beaches of remote, uninhabited islands are littered with man-made plastic trash. Joe takes a long pause, then asks,
"Do you believe in God?"
Patricia doesn't answer the question directly. She says she believes in herself.
What does that mean?
I have confidence in myself.
This still doesn't really address the God question. Joe decides to forge on with this topic. He says he's been doing some real soul searching lately. Again, more mention of souls. And he's realized something.
I have no interest in myself.
He says when he starts to think about himself, he gets bored out of his mind. Patricia has a laugh at this. She wants to know what does interest Joe. At first he says nothing, but then he thinks about it for a minute.
Courage. Courage interests me.
The courage to throw yourself into a molten volcano, maybe? Patricia doesn't see how an interest in courage lines up with someone who's planning to spend the rest of his life on a tiny island in the South Pacific.
Well, up till now, I've lived on a tiny island called Staten Island.
Yes, and he worked in Long Island City. I think we need to address this. It has been noted by several commenters that you can't commute with a car between these two locations. This became an issue because when we first met Joe, he was getting out of his car. Could he have driven to Long Island City from Staten Island? I have no firsthand knowledge about driving in New York, but I do have access to Google Maps. According to Google Maps, it is possible to drive from Staten Island to Long Island City. It takes about an hour, it's very roundabout, and it does contain multiple tolls, but I'm pretty sure you can do it. You have to cross the Verrazano Narrows Bridge, go through the Hugh Carey Tunnel, then finally go through the Queens Midtown Tunnel. The tunnels were both opened in 1940 and the bridge went into service in 1964, so Joe would have had access to all of it in 1990. Any of you refiners who live in NYC or one of the boroughs, if you have firsthand knowledge, please weigh in on the drivability between these two locations. Joe gives her a thumbnail of his former life. Looking back, he can't believe he did what he did for so long. Now he can't believe Patricia's life.
Your life seems unbelievable to me. All of this, like, life seems unbelievable to me.
Although she may be mad at him, Patricia is not hesitant to quote her father.
My father says that almost the whole world is asleep. Everybody you know, everybody you see, everybody you talk to.
Only a few people in the world are truly awake, according to Samuel.
And they live in a state of constant, total amazement.
We don't get an indication as to which kind of person Patricia is, but I think she considers herself one of those who is awake. Joe drops down on the deck so he's face to face with Patricia. She is sliding towards him. Their lips are getting very close. Joe decides to broach the death thing again, even though it hadn't gone over so well with Dee Dee.
I have less than 6 months to live.
He then rips through the whole story. Why her dad hired him. He's jumping into the volcano. Mineral rights. He lays it all out. Patricia is, well, she jumps to her feet.
What?
Joe also stands.
You're not going to make me say that again, are you?
Patricia is wide-eyed, unblinking.
Well, aren't you going to say anything?
She says she doesn't know what to say. She then gives Joe her version of Angelica's I have no response to that line. Patricia just says,
my mind is a blank.
She's not as different from her half-sister as she might like to think. Joe says he can understand the blank mind thing.
Is this disease catching?
Joe assures her it's not. Patricia still looks freaked out. She's not processing the whole thing very well. She suddenly decides she needs a bit of space.
Good night, then. I'll see you in the morning.
As she heads below decks, Joe makes a face. He either has to stop telling this story or at least come up with a different spin on it. We jump cut to the next morning. Joe is back in his jungle gym outfit. He approaches Dagmar, who's sitting in front of a complicated-looking bank of instruments.
It's a little weird today, huh?
She tells him there's a typhoon warning, then says good morning to Mr. Banks.
Good morning, Dagmar.
Out on the deck, wow, everything is green. This has to be an in-the-tank shot, possibly even an in-the-studio shot, because we never really see any water. Patricia is holding onto the rigging and standing out on the bow. Joe approaches and asks if he can help. She tells him to tie up a bit of the mast.
Feels dead, doesn't it?
Yeah, and green. She tells Mike to get below. He's supposed to turn on the engines.
Tell Tony to head us into the wind and keep us into the wind.
Joe comments for all of us when he says there isn't any wind.
There will be.
Are you worried?
Nah, she says they're ahead of the game when it comes to prep. Joe wants to know what exactly is a typhoon.
You know, Joe, I think you're going to find out.
Lightning strikes, waves start to roll, but we still don't know any specifics about a typhoon, so I looked it up. A typhoon is a tropical cyclone, but so is a hurricane. What it's called depends on where it formed. Any tropical cyclone forming in the northern hemisphere between 100 and 180 degrees east latitude with sustained winds of approximately 74 miles per hour is a typhoon. 100 degrees east extends over the entire western Pacific and all the way past the South China Sea. If that same storm forms in the north central or northeast Pacific or in the Atlantic north of the equator, those tropical cyclones are called hurricanes. The typhoon line starts well on the other side of Hawaii, so probably these guys aren't really far enough west to be in typhoon territory. What's about to hit is actually a Pacific hurricane, but typhoon sounds more exotic. Waves come rolling in. The tiny ship is tossed. If not for the courage of the fearless crew, the Tweedledee would be lost. Sorry, but those two in their rain slickers fighting with that big drive wheel look a lot like those credit scenes with the skipper and Gilligan. Huge waves completely engulf the main deck of the Tweedledee. We cut to below decks. Patricia is on the ship's radio.
Mayday, mayday. This is the Tweedledee. Latitude 10 degrees, 8 minutes south. Longitude approximately 150 degrees, 18 minutes west. We are in severe distress.
Yeah, so now we know exactly where they are, and they are a lot further than they should be. I think this might be another case of writers not doing the research. A quick refresher from junior high social studies. Lines of latitude run east and west. Zero latitude is the equator. She said they were 10 degrees, 8 minutes south latitude. This means they are just south of the equator by 10 degrees. From the equator to each pole is 180 degrees, so we're pretty close to the middle. Lines of longitude run north and south. Since the Tweedledee is out in the Pacific, they are approaching a dividing line called the antimeridian. It's kind of like the north-south version of the equator. Going from east to west, you are counting up in longitude until you cross the antimeridian. It sits at 180 degrees. Once you've crossed the antimeridian, you're now in an area of the world referred to as the Far East. After crossing the antimeridian, the longitude number starts to count back down from 180 as you continue west around the world. This spot Patricia has identified with her coordinates is about 3,700 miles from Los Angeles. They're almost 2,000 miles due south of the Big Island of Hawaii. The closest land to them would be French Polynesia. The commune island of Rangiroa is about 400 miles south-southeast of their current position. Here's where I don't think the writers did their research. According to Patricia's coordinates, they are sitting 3,700 miles from the Los Angeles departure. Unless there was a big time jump I missed, this is only our third or fourth day on board the Tweedledee. Hawaii is 2,300 miles from Los Angeles. It takes a high-performance boat a solid week to get to Hawaii from L.A. We're another 1,400 miles past that. It would have taken between 10 days and 2 weeks with perfect weather conditions for the fastest of boats to get to this spot in the Pacific. The Tweedledee has somehow managed to do it in seemingly 3 days. Landlubber Joe is still wanting to help out.
Yes. What else should I do?
Patricia tells him to definitely stay below decks.
The engine's check on Dagmar.
Down in the engine room, Dagmar says everything is looking good so far, but she wants to stay with it. She gives Joe another assignment.
Take care of Patricia.
Back in the cabin, Patricia is still broadcasting her message, even though she's pretty sure...
No way is anybody getting this!
She asks Joe how Dagmar is doing.
She's okay.
Just then, one of the guys sticks his head in the cabin. The main boom doesn't look secure. Joe pulls the hatch closed behind him. Patricia has a rope over her shoulder and appears to be headed out.
What are you doing?
It's my boat!
Joe is no longer wearing his rain slicker, but he follows her onto the main deck anyway. The guys are at the wheel. Water is sluicing everywhere. A huge wave hits Joe and washes him across the deck. Patricia is able to crawl to him.
Are you all right?
Oh, I think so.
They both stand, eyes meeting. Joe pushes back the brim of Patricia's rain hat, and they start to kiss in the driving rain. Check the pulleys hanging in the background. Is it just me, or don't those look like hearts hanging there? Her arms close around his neck. Time stands still as Joe and Patricia share a deep kiss. The typhoon, unfortunately, continues. Patricia is looking at Joe with a goofy smile on her face when suddenly...
Patricia!
The boom swings past and throws her overboard. Joe is left holding her rain hat. He looks at it, then throws it over his shoulder. This has been identified as Joe's third hat toss. This one isn't as intentional as the others have been, and it's not even his hat, but it does qualify as Joe throwing a hat. This is where we enter Joe's hero phase. He dives off the boat towards where we can see the yellow of Patricia's slicker just below the water. We watch him diving, searching for Patricia in the churning water. I hope Tom Hanks' experience in the giant water tank was better than Jim Carrey's. Not sure what I'm talking about. Make sure to check out the Severed Origins episodes where we break down The Truman Show. We see Joe pulling Patricia's rain slicker covered arms up out of the water. He has her, but can he get her back to the boat? Cinematographer Stephen Goldblatt was most likely really enjoying himself during these scenes. Goldblatt had just come off a couple of years of shooting Lethal Weapon 1 and 2. He'd also been the man behind the camera for Young Sherlock Holmes, another Amblin production. Goldblatt was known for his very kinetic and active camera work. Shanley was looking for Goldblatt's expertise, but not the high-energy camera movements. He told Goldblatt he wanted a more traditional 1940s look to the camera work. In order to get it, Shanley said Goldblatt needed to imagine the camera weighed 5,000 pounds. There are no fast whip pans or shaky running with a 5,000-pound camera. We cut back and forth from the Tweedledee to Joe and an unconscious Patricia bobbing in the waves. Lightning is dancing around the boat. Then a huge bolt comes straight down in the middle of the Tweedledee. It's big, it's powerful, and for almost a whole second, it has the shape of the crooked path we've been seeing throughout the movie. Don't miss it. This was probably a pretty expensive effect in 1990. This massive jolt of lightning is enough to split the Tweedledee in half. What I think is a miniature starts to slip below the waves. Meanwhile, Joe's massive steamer trunks are beginning to pop up out of the water. They are waterproof, you know.
Tight as a drum.
These amazing trunks have managed to work themselves free from the Tweedledee's hold and are magically following their master. Joe grabs onto one of the trunks. He uses the rope Patricia still has on her shoulder to lash himself to it. There's a dissolve for time to Joe, now unconscious and lashed to the trunk. The shot cranes up to show us Patricia laying on her back on top of the trunk. Jack and Rose are going to do a similar scene in another movie in about 7 years. The water will be quite a bit colder, and they will be floating in it after another, much larger boat breaks into and sinks. As Patricia keeps bobbing unconscious, Joe gathers up the other three trunks. He then uses Patricia's rope to lash them together. The result is a fairly large, very buoyant raft. It's probably 10 feet by 6 feet. Since the trunks are all floating upright, Joe is able to open the lids and take out things he needs. Remember the violin case bar from Homaker Schlemmer? It includes a generic green bottle of water, which is probably Perrier, but they don't let us see a label. Joe is doling out capfuls to the unconscious Patricia, but not taking any for himself. Fresh water is vital to survival. It's not easy or comfortable, but most humans can survive for up to a month without food. We can only go about 3 days without water. Remember the world band Radio? It's time for another music video. This time it's to Come Go With Me from the Del Vikings.
Come, 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 come into my town. No, darling, we will never part. I need you, darling, so come go with me.
The studio version was released in January of 1957. It would peak at number 5 on the U.S. Billboard Top 100 Pop chart. It was a predecessor to the Hot 100 chart. Rolling Stone list Come Go With Me at number 449 on their list of the 500 greatest songs of all time. Tom Hanks then kills some time dancing on the steamer trunk raft. Sometimes, especially in these later scenes, I get the feeling Spielberg told Shanley he had to get this thing to at least 100 minutes. There is no real set length for a feature. The American and British Film Institutes both count 40 minutes as long enough for a feature. The Screen Actors Guild calls a feature anything 80 minutes or longer. But among studio filmmakers, 100 minutes is kind of the unofficial bar for quantity. When the general public plunks down their money for a ticket, the belief is they will feel cheated if what they get is less than an hour and 40 minutes. I'm picturing a studio note. Have Hanks dance. That'll kill a couple of minutes. We then see Joe mixing up shaving cream to give himself a shave. Remember, we're on a raft. This makes for a fun sight gag, but I hope he didn't really do this. Shaving with salt water is painful. In the next shot, it's night. Stepping up to the plate with even more filler is Mr. Tom Hanks, now singing and playing the ukulele.
Hee-hee-o, hee-o, cowboy, 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 under the moon.
This is called simply The Cowboy Song, also written by John Patrick Shanley. If you think about it, this is a great way to skirt music rights fees. Just write your own songs to fill time in your movie. It's night, the stars are brilliant, and Patricia is still unconscious on the raft, even with Joe's singing.
And all of them coyotes singing in a prairie symphony.
Wow, it just keeps going, doesn't it? More filler the next day. Now Joe's using his putting green on the raft. It blows away before it becomes too embarrassing. We get still another music video. This one is scored by the Ink Spots and their tune, I Cover the Waterfront. Joe is covering Patricia with the red and white umbrella he threw in at the last minute during his shopping spree. Turns out it was a good choice. The next day, Joe is starting to look a bit more the worse for wear. That night, he hallucinates all of the constellations are moving by, only they're drawn in a way you'd see them on a sky chart. Cut to the sun beating down. No more dancing today. Joe looks like he might be unconscious. Is it the next night? It's kind of hard to tell. We keep jump cutting ahead. The moon is coming up. The last time we saw the moon from the boat, it was a sliver. It must have been several days at least because this one is full. A full moon is Mr. Shanley's signature, so he had to get one in. I don't know any of the mechanics of this moonrise effect, but it does look very phony. Joe, his face now dirty, his eyes a bit wild, raises his arms to the enormous moon. He then kneels on the raft and says a prayer.
Dear God, whose name I do not know, thank you for my life.
He continues for a bit, but then he collapses hard. Next, we're hearing from Patricia. She's come out of her coma, looking like she just spent 3 hours in a salon chair.
Didn't you drink any water for yourself, Joe?
She's feeding Joe a drink from the green bottle. He looks terrible, with cracked lips and red welts on his face. He tries to push it away.
That's for you.
She wants to know what happened to the Tweedledee.
Lightning!
Joe may not be up for a conversation right now, but Patricia pushes on.
No sign of Dagmar, the boys?
He says everything went down. Patricia breathes a whispered,
God.
And that's about it for any mourning. R.I.P. to Dagmar and the boys.
I still have my trunks.
We cut to a view through a telescope. The trunk raft is bobbing along under what must be the rising sun. The reverse angle reveals a large man wearing what you might call native garb, standing on a rock cliff. He's monitoring the ocean with an ancient-looking but well-maintained brass telescope. As he watches, he's drinking from a hilariously large can of soda. And yes, gang, he's drinking Jump brand orange soda. I only wish Jump had included an exclamation point. This is Brian Esteban playing the Waponi Lookout emo. Brian is another actor whose career begins and ends with this movie. Brian even has a line.
Abay!
There's a cut to a long shot of an island. It's a tiny island, but there's a large volcano at one end of it. This is Waponi Woo. We're finally here. It's taken us an hour and 20 minutes out of this hour and 40-minute movie just to make it to the island.
Abay!
What's that?
Joe and Patricia are standing on the raft. Patricia says she thinks they've been spotted.
The Waponis?
Oh, yeah. We've got Waponis everywhere. They're coming down the beach in droves. Get ready. There's a lot of weirdly sideways racist stuff happening in the next few minutes, beginning with the celebratory music the Waponis start playing. It's the Jewish tune of celebration, Have Nagila, only rewritten with Waponi lyrics. This is cute because these natives are descended from those Jewish slaves who were on the Lost Galley 1,800 years ago. This is lazy and racist because Have Nagila is not a traditional Jewish tune. It was written in the 20th century. Its first public performance was in 1918 in Jerusalem. The tune itself is older, but there's still no good explanation for how the Waponis could possibly know it. Unless whoever is supplying them with Jump soda taught them this tune. The Waponis have gone all in on this one brand of orange soda. As far as I can tell, it's been made up for the movie. Fanta missed a huge product placement opportunity. Look closely at the native garb of the islanders. Jump is such a huge part of their lives, they've incorporated dozens of Jump soda cans into their outfits. I don't know where it's coming from, but they do seem to have an endless supply of this stuff. Wildly decorated dugout canoes surround Joe's raft. Another native welcomes them.
Are you Joe?
Yeah.
This is Baugh. He's the Waponi's advance man. No, really, that's how he's identified in the credits. I recognize the voice right off, but I did a double check to make sure I was right. Yes, this is truly the star of stage, screen, and Disney movies, Mr. Nathan Lane. Nathan's true love is the stage, but he has managed to rack up 91 TV and film performer credits on his IMDb profile. This was still somewhat early in Nathan's career. He'd been doing some TV and movies going back to 1981, but this was only his sixth listed IMDb role. Baugh clarifies.
Are you Joe Banks?
When Joe confirms, the Waponis go nuts. Their savior has arrived. This would also mean Mr. Granamore has somehow sent word to the Waponis. I'm curious how he did this. The most modern device on Waponi Wu appears to be a telescope from a 19th century galleon. Maybe he sent word through their soda supplier. The music video continues with a new tune. This time the tune is When Johnny Comes Marching Home Again. It's also been re-lyriced with Waponi words. The men are blowing on conch shells. The women are twirling brightly colored parasols. I have no clue as to what outside influences have acted on the Waponis over the years, but I'd bet it's an interesting story. Although a number of the islanders do look like islanders, many of them look more like college students and crew members. The raucous procession makes its way up the hill from the beach. The Waponis are carrying both Joe and Patricia. The pair are happily feasting on grapes as they're carried along. The surging crowd delivers the recently rescued couple to a particular hut. The celebration stops when a figure appears at the door of the hut. We're given a point-of-view shot looking back over the gathered revelers. We don't see who's at the door at first. The only thing we're shown is the close-up of a small, unhappy-looking doll. Joe and Patricia are holding hands, standing in the clearing in front of the hut. We don't see it happen, but we hear it. When the small doll is revealed, the Waponis all collapse to the ground. The entire group that had been surrounding them are all lying at Joe and Patricia's feet when we cut back from the doll. Joe speaks up.
What is that? A teddy bear?
Oh, if you think real hard, Refiner, I bet you can guess what he's holding. We can now see the chief as he answers.
No, it is my soul.
Of course it is. Next to ducks and crooked paths, souls are a key topic in this movie. We're never really told why souls are important, but they must be. Joe says he hopes the chief doesn't lose his soul.
So do I.
The chief is being played by American comedic acting legend Abe Vigoda. Since Shanley is really pushing the effect of Jewish influences on the Waponis, he made a good choice here. You don't get much more Jewish than Abe Vigoda. Abraham Charles Vigoda was born in Brooklyn in February of 1921. He was the son of recently arrived Jewish immigrants from Russia. Abe would serve in the military and study acting on the GI Bill. One of his most famous roles was as Capo Regime Sal Tessio in 1972's The Godfather. Abe had been doing a lot of Broadway at the time. He didn't have an agent for TV or the movies, so he just went in and read. He got the role of Tessio through what's called an open call. Also sometimes referred to as a cattle call, the open call gives performers without agents a chance to read for big movies. Getting a role through an open call is the acting equivalent of making an NFL team as a walk-on. The role that would define Vigoda's career came about thanks to his Godfather exposure. Vigoda played world-weary cop Phil Fish on the hit sitcom Barney Miller for 61 episodes from 1974 through 81. The character was such a breakout hit, he also starred in a spin-off called simply Fish for 35 episodes in 1977. Vigoda had a total of 98 credits on his IMDb profile. Abe Vigoda passed away in 2016 at the age of 94.
I'm Toby, Chief.
I'm Joe Banks.
Joe introduces Patricia and comments on the Chief's excellent English. We don't find out how, but he says he has learned.
You came to stop the anger of the Wu?
Sure, if you say so. The chief lays out the particulars for today's festivities. There will be a big feast tonight. Following that,
you will climb to the top of the big Wu and you will jump in, okay?
Okay.
The Waponis do stay busy with their crafts. Around the chief's hut are carved dolphins, woven wicker walls, leis, and beadwork. The chief shouts a couple of words in Waponi, and we are launched into another music video. Can't you almost feel Shanley desperately trying to stretch this movie out to feature length? I couldn't find a song we're hearing listed anywhere on a soundtrack. They also don't caption the lyrics, but I think they're a mix of Waponi and English. The tune sounds a little like something the Oompa Loompas sang in Willy Wonka. We cut back and forth here between Joe's preparations and Patricia's. She is being pampered by the Waponi ladies. He is being pimped and abused. The whole sequence feels a bit forced and desperate for laughs, especially when there's a guy sucking on Joe's toes. Gross. Then they just flat out smash a banana in Tom Hanks' face. That's funny, right? I do like these scenes because we're given a chance to see how creatively the Waponis have incorporated jump soda cans into their native garb. Joe's preparation sequence ends with the Waponi men having a big laugh. Why? Well, because Joe is peeling a small octopus off his face.
All right, that's it! That's it! That's it! We're done!
Joe looks to the beach where some of the Waponis are stacking his steamer trunks. A duck is sitting on one of the trunks. Yes, it's another canard. Joe considers the duck as the Waponis continue to laugh riotously. We cut to a shot of the sun setting behind Waponi Woo. Night is falling, which means it's time for the big feast and Joe's jump. Native drums are scoring the scene. There's a shot from inside the Woo with orange lava bubbling. At the feast, we cut to a native dance number already in progress. Nathan Lane is back, now with huge finger extensions as part of his costume. Nathan, as Ba, proceeds to devour huge amounts of scenery. He runs around the assembled group crowing like a madman, all in Waponi. No word as to whether this was scripted or if Nathan was just ad-libbing his butt off. I'm sure it took more than one take, but I'm also betting this was a lot of ad-lib. When we first cut to the dance, check the mask on the guy coming out of the straw volcano. This mask is a native representation of the god Wu. It also looks exactly like the building where Joe worked in Long Island. You can see the spinning wheels, pointed dormers. It even has the smokestacks. Paul Michael Thorpe is the performer inside the Wu mask. Paul has 14 actor credits, with a dozen of those happening in the 1990s. His profession is really dancer, not actor. Ba is spouting gibberish, Waponi, but one phrase he says does get captioned.
Hella, not Velma!
Patricia is already at the feast, but Joe hasn't shown yet. She's worried.
Do you know where my friend Joe Banks is?
Well, the chief says maybe he ran away. Although we've seen the island, there are not many places to run.
Maybe you don't want to jump in the big wolf.
There's a disturbance in the crowd. The Waponis cheer. The camera tilts up to reveal Joe, fog, and mist all around him, red-eyed tikis burning to either side. He's standing there in his Armani tux. Well, of course, this is just good script writing. If you're going to have the lead buy an Armani tux in the first act, you'd better have him wearing it in the finale. Joe has also retrieved the bottle of champagne from the violin case bar. He's poured himself a glass. There's a reverse angle looking over Joe's shoulder at the cheering Waponis. Joe takes a sip of champagne. He's looking very James Bond here. Patricia is just relieved to see him. Joe takes a seat to the right hand of the Toby chief. Patricia is sitting to the chief's left. Patricia is wearing a shimmering white, very modern-looking dress. The way it fits and looks, it must be hers. I know Joe made it off the boat with his stuff. I'm curious how Patricia was able to come up with this dress.
How do you like my tux?
Patricia is not amused. This is getting far too real for her.
You really gonna do it?
Well, of course he is. Joe says he figured he might as well go out in style. Abe Vigoda then unleashes a mouthful of Waponi gibberish.
Bum, bum, bum.
The Waponis respond enthusiastically. Prepare yourself for the goofiest sight gag in the whole movie. Two enormous gongs are positioned on either side of the large fire. Two Waponi tribesmen swing in on vines crisscrossing over the fire. Each is intentionally targeting one of the large gongs. They both hit a gong and drop to the ground. This must be part of these big Waponi feasts, because a crew with a litter is ready on each side. They pick up the now unconscious gongers and haul them away. We cut back to Abe Vigoda. The chief's reaction is a very deep facepalm. The chief then addresses Joe. He says, "They are the children of children who maintain traditions, but a change has come.
The Waponis like this soda, and no one among my people would jump into the big whoop."
The chief then recaps the movie in case anyone was nodding off. He explains how Granamore made a trade for a hero, since none of the Waponis will step up. He can't do it because he is the Toby.
"I cannot be the hero. It is my place to hope for my people."
The chief is frustrated. He keeps talking. Joe says it's okay. He doesn't have any people of his own, so he's his only hope for a hero.
"Once more, I'll call upon the Waponis for a hero."
And once more, I can feel J.P. Shanley checking the runtime on his movie.
"Who knew woe's away? Who knew woe? Drama sad sets away.
Come along."
No Waponi volunteers appear. Many bow their heads or kneel. The volcano starts to rumble.
"The Wu wants his flesh."
Joe stands and raises a hand.
"Take me to the volcano!"
Another gong sounds, so they do know how to strike a gong without leaving someone unconscious. Joe looks over his shoulder to Patricia as he starts his journey up the side of the big Wu. He flashes her a thumbs up.
"Joe."
The tune to Johnny Comes Marching Home can be heard again as the procession heads up the mountain. The tune is familiar, but the words are all Waponi. Nathan Lane is getting in some more scenery chewing as he leads the procession. Yeah, I heard it, too. Granamore even called Joe Kemosabe back at his apartment. This might be a bit of his influence on the Waponis. A procession carrying torches is making its way up the mountain. As the group stretches out along the path and the camera dissolves to an overhead, we can see the shape of the route they are taking. Surprise, surprise, it's the crooked path, the lightning bolt, the hole in Joe's wall. These hints have all been leading to this final crooked journey and Joe's demise as a hero. When they get to the top, Joe asks if there's a ceremony or anything.
"No, you just jump in."
We get more rumbling accompanied by some good Star Trek-level camera shaking. Patricia has been chasing Joe up the mountain, trying to get by the Waponis who were following. She makes it to the top as Joe is conferring with the chief.
"Stop right there! I love you!"
Oops, now this is a wrinkle in the plan. Joe looks a bit embarrassed. Patricia says she has fallen in love with him.
"I've never loved anybody. I don't know how it happened. I never even slept with him or anything."
And now that she's finally found someone, he's going to kill himself. Joe turns to the chief.
"Can you give us a minute?"
Before answering, the chief does a pronounced turn to have a look at the volcano. He turns back with a nod, but his body language is saying, "Don't take too long."
"You love me?"
Yes, she does. Patricia then delivers the melodramatic line,
"You just can't die and leave me here on the stinking earth without you."
For some reason, this line is mentioned in an IMDb trivia item as being one of Shandley's trademarks, having one lover say this line to the other. It's a good line, but after some extensive Googling, I couldn't find another instance where Shanley uses this same line in a script. I'm not sure how it's a trademark if this is the only place he's ever used it. Joe says he's gotta do it.
"Why? Why? The chief doesn't even want you to do it. Do you, chief?"
Joe claims he's wasted his entire life, and besides, he's gonna die anyway.
"Now I have a chance to die like a man, and I'm gonna take it. I've got to take it."
Patricia then makes an argument which always carries particular weight in the genre of the rom-com.
"I love you."
"Oh yeah, well Joe loves her too."
"I've never been in love with anybody before either. It's great. I am glad."
Meg's face breaks into a huge smile here.
"But the timing stinks."
He tells her he's got to go and heads up a steep flight of stone steps. Reality check regarding where they are. Remember, this is a fairy tale filtered through 1940s Hollywood. If you were to actually stand on the lip of an active volcano, you're in a very dangerous place. You would be pelted by falling ash and rocks, lava, and pyroclastic flows can easily form anywhere. And most dangerous of all, the toxic volcanic gases emanating from the lava pool choke out all available oxygen. Getting this close to a volcano this active would probably cause a person to pass out. I was surprised to see the tribe keeps the volcano diving board in such good shape, considering it is only used once every 100 years. It is possible the Waponis have been up here getting things ready for Joe's arrival. The shot looking out onto the volcanic diving board looks more like a play set than anything we've seen so far. Patricia follows Joe up the stairs. He tells her to go back down.
Please let me do what I gotta do!
Patricia ignores him and continues to tromp up the stairs.
Marry me!
What?
Patricia then calls to the chief. She wants him to come up here with them. They don't show it, but I sensed Abe Vigoda unleashing a wicked eye roll at this. Abe appears at the top of the stairs. Patricia asks if he will marry them.
Okay.
Joe says he doesn't want to get married. Patricia gets right in his face with the reality of the situation.
You're going to have to love and honor me for about 30 seconds. You can't handle that?
Joe gives in.
You want to marry her?
Yes.
Patricia, same question.
You're married.
The Waponis don't mess around when it comes to the wedding ceremony, but I shouldn't be surprised. They also have the no frills, no ceremony volcano jump. The soundtrack includes a few bars of the wedding recessional. The chief turns to head back down.
I'm going now.
Patricia tells Joe not to jump. He won't listen. He says he has to be brave. These are his last words.
I gotta be brave. I gotta jump in. Goodbye.
Wow, he does take his commitment seriously, doesn't he? We cut to an up-angle view from inside the volcano. As Joe walks out on the diving board, flames belch up in front of him. There are explosions. Rocks are flying. Patricia has followed him.
Please don't come out here.
You are not the only one with last words, you know.
What?
But she can't think of anything to say. Oh no, hold on. She does have something to say.
I'm jumping in with you.
She didn't sign up for this. Joe tells her she doesn't have to do this for him.
I'm not doing it for you.
An explosion shakes the platform as Joe grabs Patricia. We cut to a down-angle view from above their vantage point. The Woo is angry. Patricia says nobody knows anything. They can take this jump and then they'll see.
That's life.
Joe then calls back their ocean adventure.
I saw the moon when we were out there on the ocean. Shine it down on everything.
Joe, buddy, this is kind of a tense spot for a monologue.
I've been miserable so long. Years of my life wasted.
Yeah, okay. Can we wrap this up? Woo is getting downright mad.
Been a long time coming here to meet you. A long time on a crooked road.
And there it is, the symbolism of the crooked road, which we've been seeing since the opening shot, is wrapped neatly around the movie like a big crooked bow. Joe then gives us another callback. Remember what he told Dee Dee? He tells Patricia the same thing.
Did I ever tell you? The first time I saw you, felt like I'd seen you before.
This time, we know it's true. Patricia says he's not going anywhere without her, and they embrace. We get a serious kiss as the volcano unleashes the biggest explosion yet. Joe steadies himself, then looks down into the molten lava.
So what are we hoping for here?
A miracle?
Miracle.
This is it. This is really it. We get a close-up as Patricia takes Joe's hand, their fingers intertwined, cut to that up-angle POV from inside the volcano. They exchange I love yous.
Okay.
And jump. It is so green screen phony, but the two lovers leap into the fiery abyss. Just then, a cloud of gas erupts out of the lava. It shoots Joe and Patricia, still holding hands, up and out of the volcano. Cut to the long shot of the island and then to an up-angle view from the POV of the Waponis. Joe and Patricia look like a rocket launch with a contrail behind. They are deposited in the ocean. Meanwhile, the Waponis are running back down the mountain through fire. Woo is erupting and the island is in serious danger. Joe and Patricia are bobbing in the water well away from the molten lava.
Why aren't you dead?
Why aren't you dead?
I don't know.
Because it's a love story and it's a comedy. Sure, in a tragedy like Romeo and Juliet, you can kill off the star-crossed lovers and get away with it. Not in a 100-minute fairy tale farce like this. These two had to live, even if the way they avoided death borders on being cartoon stupid.
The volcano!
It blew us out! We jumped in and it blew us out!
Woo is erupting with a cloud of steam and an orange light. The island, as predicted by legend, is sinking into the ocean.
There goes Waponi Woo.
And all the Waponis with it. You're being kind of cavalier there, Joe. Patricia offers up the same lament as when she heard about Dagmar and the boys.
God!
Quick question here. As the island sinks, wouldn't the sea be filled with drowning Waponis all thrashing around like survivors of a sinking ship? We don't see a single Waponi the rest of the movie. Since the movie has been talking about jumping into a volcano for more than an hour now, I get kind of curious what really happens if a person jumps into a volcano. Do we even know? Yeah, we do. I found a great article from the December 7, 2011 issue of Wired magazine. They talked to Eric Climitti, who is a volcanologist and eruptions expert, about what happens if you either fall, are pushed, or jump into a volcano. His interest came about because of the fate of Gollum. If you don't know why, go watch Return of the King. Well, okay, if you don't want to watch, spoilers for Return of the King, Gollum dove into the lava of Mount Doom, where he then sunk. According to Eric, this can't happen. Lava is always depicted as being very fluid, almost like bright orange water when we see it in movies and on TV. What everybody seems to forget, lava is molten stone. Even though it's been heated to the point of being able to flow, lava is still as dense as stone. It's also stone heated to somewhere between 1200 and 2200 degrees. According to Climitti, jumping on molten lava would be like jumping on stone. Somebody big like me might make a bit of an impression in the surface of the lava, but there's definitely no sinking into it. Eric even tested this hypothesis by throwing a bundle, roughly the size, weight, and shape of a person, into an active volcano. The bundle landed solidly on the surface of the lava and immediately burst into flame. This brings us to the other thing we definitely know about jumping into a volcano. There's no surviving it. This next part's a little gross. Eric says after you hit, your body will basically explode. All the fluid inside you will suddenly be boiling. It has nowhere to go except out. Just something to keep in mind in case you're ever approached about jumping into a volcano. Patricia says they really lucked out. Joe doesn't completely agree.
Well, I hate to bring it up, but we're a billion miles from no place.
The only land within sight just sank into the sea.
We're gonna drown.
Feisty Patricia, who started this journey kind of negative, turns out to be the optimist here. She says they're gonna be all right. The island may have sunk, but you know what could never sink? Joe's luggage. There's a roar that makes them both look. On cue, Joe's incredible steamer trunks come bobbing to the surface. I'm glad they were still closed because, as you know, they are waterproof.
Tight as a drum.
Joe and Patricia swim over to Joe's amazing trunks as we watch Waponi Woo slip beneath the ocean's surface. Jump cut to Patricia holding a lantern and floating by on the newly assembled trunk raft.
Isn't this romantic? Who gets a honeymoon like this?
Joe says, yeah, but...
I still have a problem.
Remember the little matter of only 6 months to live?
I have a brain cloud.
He says this with great gravitas. Patricia, quite rationally, sounds confused.
Brain cloud. What is a brain cloud?
Joe starts to explain, but stops. He says maybe he should have gotten a second opinion. You think?
You didn't get a second opinion about something called a brain cloud?
Give him a break. He wasn't feeling too good at the time.
I mean, what are you, a hypochondriac?
Joe says he was, but not now. Patricia doesn't think there's anything wrong with him.
Dr. Ellison said I was only going to...
This catches Patricia's attention.
Dr. Ellison?
Yeah.
You are not going to believe this. She says that's her father's doctor.
Dr. Ellison doesn't have any other patients. My father owned Dr. Ellison.
Kind of a harsh way to describe their relationship, but it does call into question Joe's diagnosis. I'm a little concerned about how long it takes Joe to figure out what happened. He seems more on the ball than this.
He set you up.
And practically got him killed.
Who?
My father.
You mean he
set
me up?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
Come on, Joe, figure it out.
I don't have a brain cloud.
Patricia is shocked they couldn't have come up with something more believable than brain cloud.
My whole life, I've been a victim. I've been a dupe, a pawn.
Joe's imagined maladies are returning and quickly. He's grabbing at his throat, checking his glands. He felt fine 2 minutes ago. Now he's getting sick again.
My throat is closing up.
Patricia tells him to stop it. He has his whole life ahead of him. In kind of an odd little two-shot, Patricia convinces Joe this is all good. Well, all good, except...
What is it now?
Joe says they're on a raft. There's no land in sight.
I don't know.
Patricia starts nodding and flashes a cute little smile.
It's always going to be something with you, isn't it, Joe?
He sheepishly says, yeah, but I'd say no land is kind of a big thing. Joe then gets serious and tells her wherever they go, whatever they do,
we're going to take this luggage with us.
Deal.
It has saved Joe more than once. Barry, the luggage guy, would be so happy to hear about this.
A real journey.
Joe and Patricia kiss on the bobbing raft. Patricia wonders where they'll end up, and Joe gives us our final callback.
Hell, away from the things of man, my love. Away from the things of man.
And, of course, our fairy tale wouldn't be complete without a line in the same font that opened the show, telling us they lived happily ever after. Just in case you're not sure if we're really done, then we get an animated The End, looking like it's being written onto the screen. And you thought I was kidding about Shanley trying to get it to 100 minutes. The End comes up at exactly 97 and a half minutes. But with credits, JVV gets tipped into the 100-minute-plus category. That's going to do it for the Severed Origins breakdown of Joe versus the Volcano. It's one of the things that inspired Dan Erickson during his creation of Severance. I'm glad he saw something in there. It was fun, but I'll take Sleepless in Seattle any day. Before you hit the elevator, Refiner, a reminder about the Severed Patreon page. It's your chance to help me out, support the podcast, and join the fun as a patron Refiner. The Severed Patreon page is your place for Severance talk, behind-the-scenes info, and other goodies you won't get from the regular podcast. Become a patron Refiner by going to patreon.com/severedpod. That's patreon.com/severedpod. As a recent retiree, I need to make some money off this podcasting thing, or I might have to go out and find a real job. I'd rather keep podcasting. Sign up now for only $5 a month, a little bit from a lot of people, is what makes it work. As always, I'm keeping an eye on Season 2 production. Nothing new to report just yet. Make sure to keep tabs on the Severed Facebook page, even if you don't become a patron. I'll be reporting on all the details about the Season 2 premiere as soon as we know anything. All right, Refiners, it's time to wrap things up for the day. You can exit via the elevator, and remember, as always, please stagger your exits.
You've been listening to Severed, the Ultimate Severance Podcast. Severed is written, produced, and hosted by Alan Stair.
Severed is not endorsed by Red Hour Productions, Endeavor Content, or Apple TV+. This podcast is intended for entertainment and informational purposes only.
Severance, the Severance logo, and all video and audio of Severance and Severance characters are registered trademarks of Red Hour, Endeavor Content, Apple TV+, or their respective copyright holders.
Please make sure to leave a 5-star rating and review for Severed at Apple Podcasts.